Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana. The Corkscrew carries a full line of wines, beers, and spirits for everyone from the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held every Friday from 6 to 8 p.m. and Saturday from 2 to 6. Information available at 337-7704 or on the web at thecorkscrew.com.
Thanks to our listeners' generosity, during our May campaign, we have moved closer to reaching our program support goal for the next fiscal year. Now, we need to finish the job. It's not too late for you to help. If you miss the membership drive, please take a moment to mail a contribution to 300 North Goodwin Avenue, Urbana, Illinois, 61801. And thank you.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in. On the program today, we'll get a glimpse of what happens inside a criminal courtroom. Our guest is journalist Steve Bogira. He spent a year in a courtroom of the Cook County Criminal Courts building, and he's written a book about what he learned in the space of that year, looking at the system from a number of perspectives. The judge, the lawyers, jurors, defendants. The title of the book, Courtroom 302, A Year Behind the Scenes in an American Criminal Courthouse. Early in his book, Bogira quotes John Altgeld, a man who served as a judge in Cook County and was later elected governor. No man can examine the great penal system of this country without being astounded at its magnitude, its cost, and its unsatisfactory results. Altgeld made the comment in 1890. Today, the Cook County Courthouse on 26th Street in Chicago, which opened in 1929, processes more felony cases than any other courthouse in the country. Our guest, Steve Bogira, is a prize-winning reporter for the Chicago Reader. He's worked for the Reader since 1981. His book, Courtroom 302, is published by Knopf. Steve, thanks so much for joining me this afternoon.
Glad to be with you, Celeste.
What led you to commit yourself to spend a year in one courtroom?
Well, I found the other stories I've done took me down to that courthouse, and I found it a fascinating place. I also found it a very important place. We spend billions on criminal justice in this country, and we have more than 2 million people behind bars, and all these people get behind bars by passing through a courtroom like the one I wrote about. But we know very little about those courtrooms. I'm glad that you mentioned the Altgeld quote, no one can examine the great penal system of this country without being really stunned at its magnitude and how little it accomplishes. The problem is very few people do examine the great penal system of this country. What we know about criminal justice comes from shows like Law and Order and from celebrity cases, and those really give us a false impression of what really goes on.
Yeah. Well, most of us do get our sense of the justice system from television drama and news reports of sensational cases. Does the view we get come anywhere near the reality?
It really comes nowhere near the reality, Celeste. In the TV dramas, cases are usually almost always going to trial before a jury, and in reality, the vast majority of cases end up being guilty pleas. The trials on TV are usually before packed galleries. There are people there for the victim's family, the defendant's family, interested members of the community, the press. In reality, in the courtroom that I monitored, the galleries often were empty. Sometimes I was the only one there. No one was there for the victim frequently, and often no one from the defendant's family either. Also the celebrity cases would lead one to believe that defendants tend to be wealthy and they tend to have the best lawyers that money can buy. And in reality, most defendants, the vast majority of defendants, are poor. They're usually black and Hispanic in big city courtrooms, and they're represented typically by overworked public defenders who really have very little time for their cases.
Yeah. Well, the television shows are popular, of course, because of the drama that they serve up. Are the day-to-day proceedings of a courtroom like Courtroom 302 dramatic?
Well, I think they're extremely dramatic, but you have to look beneath the surface to find the drama sometimes. Frequently what's happening in a courtroom on a morning is there will be a defendant and his public defender and the prosecutor standing before a judge at the bench working out the details of a plea bargain. And they're talking in code, really. You hear a lot of abbreviations, and a lot of what's said is mumbled, so it's hard for spectators to know what's going on. But when you realize how much is on the line in each case, even in a low-level felony case, the courtroom I was watching had just felony cases, you realize that it is very dramatic because the person's freedom is at stake. What the judge says will determine, and the outcome of this plea conference will determine whether he's going to be going to prison or whether he'll go free. And sometimes, often cases end up with probation, but probation is really hardly a slap on the wrist because it's a felony conviction which affects a person's life and his or her chance to get work for the rest of their life.
This is amazing to me. This was amazing that at 26th in California there in Chicago, on one day's docket, you have 1,100 cases scheduled for 30 courtrooms. Those are all the courtrooms in the complex, 30 courtrooms. The judge presiding in courtroom 302 was Judge Daniel Locallo. And one day he sees 20 defendants. In a year, he may preside over more than a dozen jury trials, close to 100 bench trials, hundreds of guilty pleas. Is that typical?
You're right. That is typical. It's an amazing workload, and because of that workload, you can imagine how little attention individual cases will get.
Yeah. Well, you say somewhere, I think, early in the story, in the book, Courtroom 302, people, the system demands that things just be pushed through, that people act reflexively, not reflectively.
Yeah, there's, and I think I quote the presiding judge in the courthouse, that's the chief judge, saying that you don't really get, thoughtfulness is something that it doesn't fit in on a cost-benefit sheet. So the people in the system realize that they're not really putting much thought into what they're doing, except in the extraordinary case that gets a lot of press attention. And I think the result is that the courts are a revolving door in many cases. If a defendant who committed a crime does not eventually commit another one, it has nothing to do with the courts. It's not because the courts have deterred him. Because I think that defendants are often moved by their circumstances to do what they do. And no one in the court system looks at what the circumstances of a crime are. Now, I don't know if the courts are capable of doing that, but somebody's got to do it, otherwise they will continue to be a revolving door.
Yeah. Let's back up and talk about the courthouse itself. Would you describe it for us, the complex at 26th in California?
Sure. It's an old building. It opened on April Fool's Day, 1929, so it's 76 years old now. It's seven stories high, limestone building. It looks like a museum, but it looks like a lost museum because in Chicago it's on the southwest side in an isolated neighborhood. That was really by choosing in 1929. The previous criminal courthouse was downtown, but the city's leaders felt that it would be better to get the riffraff out of the loop. And I think that really is emblematic for how we treat criminal justice. It's something we don't really want to look at closely. The building has an unwelcoming tenor to it. There's signs of prohibition in the hallways, on the walls. There are no benches in the hallways for people to sit while they're waiting to go into courtrooms. The washrooms are often in a decrepit state. So it's not a building that people go to by choice. It's also a building that there's a racial divide that you can see right at the front entrance. There are metal detectors there, and typically the people who are coming to court because they're going to be a witness, or they're a defendant out on bond, or a family member of a victim or of a defendant, those people go through the metal detectors, and most of those people are black or Hispanic. The employees tend to be white, and so they usually use their badge or their ID and walk into the building. So you see this kind of racial divide right at the entrance to the courthouse.
Yeah. You were familiar with the courthouse prior to embarking on this project. A couple of questions here. When did you first set foot in the courthouse for the very first time? When did you set foot in the courthouse, and what were your first impressions?
I think it was in the mid-1980s, Celeste, and I just went down there to see what was happening. And I remember feeling small because of how big everything was. As I said, it's a seven-story building. The older courtrooms, the original courtrooms, are on floors 4 through 7. And those are, those of us who are old enough to remember Perry Mason, those are Perry Mason-style large courtrooms, really rather elegant, trimmed in oak. And I remember sitting in one of those courtrooms. On the second and third floors are the newer courtrooms that were added, I believe, in 1970. And courtroom 302 was one of those. Those are less than half the size. The gallery is separated from the front of the courtroom by bulletproof glass.
Yeah.
It's really not necessary, the glass. I mean, no one has ever... I know we had a shooting in an Atlanta courthouse recently, but the deputies in this courthouse are not allowed to carry guns, and there hasn't been a shooting there in 35 years. So there's this bulletproof glass separating the people in the back of the courtroom from the people in front. So that's my original impression, again, was just feeling really small from how big everything was.
Yeah, and everything is moving along so quickly. The cafeteria, or I don't even know if you could call it a cafeteria, it's so tiny, and it's just people are just, it's like it's another revolving door within a building of revolving doors, I suppose.
Yeah, well, the cafeteria there, they don't call it a cafeteria. The people who work in the courtroom anyway refer to it as the Gangbanger Cafe, which is kind of a slap at the people who are, the visitors who use it.
Yeah. The judge who presided over courtroom 302 the year you were there, what would you like to say about him? What kind of a judge is he?
He's, like most of us, a complicated individual. He works very hard. He's ambitious. He wants to rise to the appellate court. This was in the year I wrote, and he's still hoping to rise to the appellate court. He knows the law. He studies it closely. He's respectful to defendants. He doesn't put a lot of time into the kinds of things that I was talking about earlier, the context of crime or trying to figure out a defendant's motivation or what might be able to change what seems to be a repeated course of events. But judges don't have a lot of discretion. There's not a whole lot that they can do. They're usually sentencing is picking a number, in a range of numbers. So Daniel Locallo is a guy who works hard and knows the law, and I think he's one of the better judges in the system. He's repeatedly gotten great evaluations from the bar associations down here. But you see in the book how little even a good judge or a judge who works hard can do.
Yeah. It seems that he can run a courtroom according to his standards. That's something a judge can do, administer the courtroom. And then sentencing, that's another big area that there is some control over. And it was interesting to me to learn that here's one area where he's been criticized for his how he reaches a decision on a sentence. He might take into account who shows up in the courtroom.
Yeah, one of the issues I get into, he has a trial where a defendant is charged with murder, and the victim's family comes to court on every court date, and that's something he factors into. He tells me he factors into the sentencing. He says sometimes you consider who weeps for the deceased, and there are lawyers I talk to who say, well, you know, that's not a proper consideration over the length of somebody's sentence. It shouldn't matter whether the victim's family is coming to court. He also factors in what kind of victim the victim was. In this case that I'm talking about, this murder, the victim was a college student, and the judge tells me that if it's someone who had some chances of being a real productive citizen who is lost, that's a bigger loss to society, and he considers that a factor in determining the defendant's sentence. You can see how complicated these decisions can be, and I don't spend a lot of time in the book criticizing. It's a book of observation, and I like to allow readers to make up their own minds, but I like to present them with these kind of complicated sets of issues so they know what's really going on in these courtrooms.
Yeah. How do that? You said that he received good ratings, good evaluations from the Bar Association. What about prosecutors?
Prosecutors aren't as crazy about him. Judge Locallo is a former prosecutor, but prosecutors feel he doesn't give stiff enough sentences except in what they're called heater cases, cases that get press attention. There's a lot of heat on the courtroom. That's why they're called that. So they wish he would give stiffer sentences, but prosecutors usually want that. Also, Locallo is the judge who will say not guilty more often than a lot of judges. It's funny, Celeste, former prosecutors, sometimes you'd think former prosecutors would go on to be prosecution-oriented judges, and often they do, but some prosecutors are less willing to believe police, and a lot of cases come down to credibility contests between the defendant and police. Prosecutors, when they were state's attorneys, had to work with police as witnesses, and they know that police sometimes lie. Defense lawyers worked with defendants, and so they know that defendants lie. So sometimes the defense lawyer goes on to be more state-oriented, and the prosecutor goes on to be more defense-oriented. And I think that's happened in part with Locallo. Locallo's dad was a police captain, so he also got messages from his dad saying, you know, a lot of times, especially in drug cases, you can't believe what the police have to say.
In the book, early in the book, we accompany a man facing a drug charge and facing charges of violating terms of probation, a guy by the name of Larry Bates. Mm-hmm. Tell us about him.
Larry Bates was a high school graduate who had not had a criminal offense until he turned 42. Most people who do get involved in crime do so earlier in their teens or 20s. But Larry Bates was a working man, but he worked in a warehouse most of his life, but he had some problems which led him to a crack cocaine addiction in the 1980s. I follow him through the book and talk about how he's arrested the first time for possession of half a gram of heroin, actually, he probably was selling it. And so he gets probation on that case, but he doesn't get any drug treatment. And so he picks up another case. First, I show him coming to court because he's violated the terms of the probation. He hasn't finished his community service, and he hasn't finished it because he's still got this cocaine addiction, which is causing him to act irresponsibly. And I talk with Larry Bates, and he knows that he's stuck on stupid, as he puts it, and he regrets it, and he's actually embarrassed when he comes to court. He doesn't he takes the stairs instead of the elevator because he doesn't want anybody he knows to see him there. He feels like he's embarrassing the Larry Bates is black, and he sees the other black staff members there, and he feels like he sees judgment in their eyes, and as if he's shaming not only himself but his brothers and sisters. So I think Larry Bates represents what a lot of people in this country are going through. In this courthouse, as in so many urban courthouses, most of them in this country, most people are facing drug charges. Most of them are there because they've got cocaine or a heroin addiction. And whatever happens to them in court, it frequently doesn't stop them from being addicted to drugs. It just gives them another problem, because Larry Bates comes out of this with a felony record, and finding work becomes even more difficult.
Hmm. So on one day's docket, out of that 1,100 cases, how many are drug cases?
Probably two-thirds.
Two-thirds.
Yeah.
For a gram of something or other.
Sometimes it's a little bit more, but often it's less. I looked at police reports, and time and again, it would say 0.1 gram, 0.2 gram, 0.3 grams. This is like a sneeze and it's gone amounts of cocaine or heroin. Hmm. And I wanted to just add about Larry Bates.
Sure.
That in talking to him in the gallery and getting to know him a little bit, it turns out that when he was in his late 20s, he was married, and his wife had one child and then another, and after the second one was born, his wife was acting kind of funny, and Larry Bates kind of ignored the warning signals, as he would realize later. But one day she called him at his job and said that somebody had taken the baby, and Larry Bates came home, and police were looking around, and it was clear they didn't believe what Larry Bates' wife said about what had happened to the baby, and it turned out that the baby, Larry Bates' wife, had drowned the baby in a diaper pail. Larry Bates, his cocaine addiction started after this. He started drinking heavily. He was laid off around 1980, as a lot of people were in a recession we had then. So he had a lot of personal problems that preceded his use of crack cocaine. Does that excuse the fact or something about him getting addicted to cocaine? I mean, in an ideal world, it wouldn't. But a lot of defendants have circumstances which lead them in certain directions, and Larry Bates certainly did.
What happened to him?
I follow that through the book. He gets probation again from Judge Locallo. At one point, he wants to get out of jail for a weekend because Locallo is offering him probation with drug treatment, but he's got to wait in the jail for a treatment bed to open. And there's a scene in the book about Larry Bates asking for release for a weekend so he could see his son graduate from high school. Locallo first says no, but later he considers, Locallo thinks about his own kids' graduation and how much he'd like to, you know, he wouldn't miss that for the world, and he decides to let Larry go for the weekend. And Larry makes it to is at his son's graduation and comes back to court, and then he goes to jail, and he has to wait for weeks, finally gets in a treatment center. He gets some treatment, but he comes back to his community, and as is often the case, there are people who are selling drugs on the block where he lives. He hears rocks and blows is the call by the people who are selling the drugs. And he gets back involved after a few months in using again, and he ends up picking up another case and this time going to prison. And I think that's frequently the path that people follow. We read about cases where people are sentenced to 25 years for having a gram of cocaine, but that's not really the typical case in the state court. It's more the revolving door thing where people they work their way up. They make progress, but the progress they make is they work their way from probation to a small prison term to a longer one. Right now, Larry Bates is out of prison, but he's back to the same problem of trying to find work. He puts on his application that he has a felony record. no one calls him back. So the last time I talked with him, which was just last week, he was living in a shelter on the west side.
Hmm. Journalist Steve Bogira, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of Courtroom 302, A Year Behind the Scenes in an American Criminal Courthouse, this American Criminal Courthouse in Chicago, the Cook County Courthouse. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions, comments. 333-9455, the number to call in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. It seems to me it's pretty rare for reporters to talk with defendants. You talked with defendants in the course of doing the reporting for Courtroom 302. What did they want to talk about? How did they talk about why they found themselves in the system?
The first thing is they're surprised that somebody's interested. And they also, the first thing is they expect that you want to know whether they did the crime they're charged with. I don't usually start by asking them whether they did the crime because I expect them to say, no, I didn't do it, and a lot of times they did. And I don't think it's a good way to start. It's the right foot to start on by having somebody lie to you. So I usually ask them about themselves, you know, where they grew up, if they went to high school, how far and where. And I ask them a little bit about their families. And eventually I may turn the conversation to the crime they're charged with, but I'm really not as interested in finding out about that. You know, I learn a lot about that from the police records, and I do talk to them about that usually, but I'm more interested in what led them to court, how they ended up in court.
Mm-hmm.
And by talking to them that way, people were honest with me. I didn't find defendants, there were defendants who said that they didn't do it. Some of them maybe didn't do it. But there were a lot of defendants who admitted to me that they had done the crime they were charged with. A lot of them were more honest with me than they were with their lawyers, because I could compare notes later with some of the lawyers who would talk to me off the record. But the striking thing was how fascinated they were, and how appreciative, really, that somebody bothered to want to know about their story.
Mm. Like Larry Bates, is there a lot of expression of I'm stuck on stupid or, you know, what have I done? And, as you talk with folks, I wonder, you know, what is it that they really want to talk about once you've got the conversation going and you ask a question and you listen and maybe there's a bit of silence there at some point and they start talking about their situation.
Yeah, it's really not that different from conversations with people who aren't defendants. People in the courtroom even expressed that somebody's interested in what I do. The lawyers and even the judge, most of the time, reporters don't talk to them. Reporters come out for headline cases, and then they're usually looking for a quick soundbite type quote. But to ask someone what it is they do and how they feel about it, again, I'm struck by how appreciative people are of that. Defendants are even more so that way, I think, because they're usually poor, and poor people rarely get that kind of ear from anyone, whether it's a doctor or, someone in a social worker. People are, in the lives of the poor, people tend to be really rushed. It's not just in the courthouse. I did get a letter from one of the, since this book came out, and it just came out, I've already gotten a letter from one of the defendants who I followed in the book, and he's in a maximum security prison right now for a murder he was convicted of. And he expressed this appreciation for what I wrote about him, even though what I wrote was not it was not like you didn't do this crime, you were railroaded, the sentence was too long. That's not at all what I wrote. I described what happened in his case, and I also talked a little bit about his background. And he just was gratified that somebody cared enough to listen and to write that kind of a story from their perspective. Mm-hmm. I've heard from other inmates in prison who have seen this book and, again, are really appreciative of the fact that somebody is telling the story from the point of view, and it's not just from the point of view of the defendants, but that that's part of the book. I start the book by talking about what it's like for the prisoners who are dropped out and mm-hmm. dropped off in the courthouse basement, and they get the baptism from the deputies. The baptism consists of the deputies screaming and cursing them out. Setting the tone is what the deputies call it. This is something that all these defendants go through, but as far as I've never seen this kind of thing described. We think what happens in the courtroom itself is all that goes on, but there's a lot that precedes it.
How many reporters cover the Cook County Courthouse full time?
Three.
Phew.
So that, you know, I feel for them because, and they would tell me how frustrating the job was because they would have a set of cases that they were supposed to give reports to their editors about every day. They were the sensational cases, you know, congressman molest teen kind of cases. And so they would have a half dozen to a dozen courtrooms to be shuttling in between. And so a lot of times if they happened into my courtroom, you know, they would ask me about what was going on because all they had time for was for maybe a juicy quote of testimony.
Mm-hmm.
It was difficult for me sitting in a courtroom day after day watching a case closely to understand what was going on. The book is about 1998, but I took years afterwards going through records and interviewing people to try to understand not just what was happening on the surface, but what was happening beneath the surface. So imagine what it's like for a reporter who sits in on a case for a few minutes and then writes a story about it.
Yeah. I've got a number of people waiting to talk with us now. The phone lines have lit up. But just to say that in another way, you talk about 30 courtrooms, 30 countries. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a big building, and there are so many cases, so many people.
Yes, they're all like a different world in each courtroom.
Yeah. Let's talk with our first listener this afternoon. Joins us from Chicago on line 4. Good afternoon.
Oh, good afternoon. I find this very interesting. First, I want to tell you where I'm coming from. So, I think Governor Ryan made a mistake when he gave a universal commutation. That's the first thing I want to say. And now I'll ask the question, how do you feel about super maximum security prisons? How do you feel about those?
Mm-hmm. Well, the super max prisons are, from what I've read about them, they're just extraordinarily inhuman places. And I don't really understand. I mean, I understand that there are prisoners who are extremely difficult to deal with. And I don't know what the solution is for dealing with them. But I don't know that the Supermax is a solution because, you know, I guess it exists to threaten inmates. If you do something, this is where you're going to end up.
Well, if we don't have the death penalty, shouldn't they be a deterrent? In other words, a lot of these prisoners, if they're doing 100 years, what do they got to lose if they kill a guard or they kill an inmate?
And so you're saying the answer is to have the Supermax to prevent that kind of...
I'm saying that, yes, that's one thing, but I'm saying that don't the other prisoners have a right to do their time without being threatened, and shouldn't the guards have more safety?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I don't know that the threat of a Supermax causes inmates to behave better, but perhaps the ones who are in Supermax at least are prevented from doing harm to guards or to other prisoners. You're right.
I want to thank the listener for his call. I've got a couple other listeners waiting to talk with Steve Bogira this afternoon. Next, we go to Eureka, line 1. Hi.
Hi. I know numbers are hard to quantify, but I get a picture in my mind, and I heard you on another program from a Chicago talk show that it's just sort of a sense I get that could one say, and I realize generalizations are may not hold up, but the vast majority of the persons in the Cook County Jail are illiterate and possibly have an alcohol or drug problem, and would a sizable majority of them represent a threat to the safety and security of society as you observe them?
Okay. Yeah, I think that in terms of literacy, that is a big problem. You're right, it's hard to quantify, but I have corresponded with several of the defendants who were in the book who are now locked up. Some of them are extremely bright and extremely and definitely literate, and some of them have great difficulty writing. And some of them, it's clear from talking with them that they have someone else write the letter for them. Mm-hmm. So I think literacy is a big problem. There's no question that alcohol and drugs, that alcohol and drug addiction is a huge problem. I mean, they take urine samples from inmates in this jail, as they do in a number of jails, and a real high percentage of them, I believe 80% and up, test positive for marijuana, cocaine, heroin. I don't know if the 80% includes alcohol. I don't think it does. I think mm-hmm. it's just drugs.
Is that upon entering prison or what? And do
yeah,
they continue to do that?
Upon entering. Okay. You're right there. I mean, I don't know if you're suggesting that there's drugs in prison.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, I've heard there certainly are. Yeah.
But certainly they come in off the street. Often they come in high, and the first thing that happens is they're withdrawing from heroin or cocaine. Mm-hmm. And in terms of a threat to society, I would say no. They're more of a threat to themselves in a way. Again, most of the people are not there they're not charged with violent offenses. Does that mean they've never committed violent offenses? Not necessarily, but most of them today are petty drug offenders. The deputies tell me that they used to do this, what I alluded to earlier, to setting the tone when they got into the courthouse. In the 1980s, they say that was more necessary because so many of the defendants were gangbangers. Now they're more often low-level drug users. But the deputies, old habits die hard, so they still set the tone.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Next we go to a listener on a cell phone in Chicago. Hi.
Hi. I'm not sure if I'm going to be cut off. I was just wondering, I'm the mother of a young college student who is thinking about law school, and I'm wondering whether or not this might be good reading material for him. He's a quiet, thoughtful person, and part of me thinks that would scare the hell out of him, but I guess I can just have a look at it and decide for myself. But I'm wondering if, gone through this experience, you feel disillusioned by the legal system, if you feel like everybody is sort of doing the best they can, or do you think that we've just made a mess of things? And I am not able to hear you, so I will hang up and listen if
okay.
I'm still connected even.
You're still
Thank
connected.
You.
Okay.
Okay.
Good questions.
A couple of, good questions. I do think this is good material for people who are considering law or criminal justice careers. It may scare the hell out of him, but that might be a good thing. I think people need to go into their careers with their eyes open. Somebody who reads this book won't necessarily say, I don't want to do this, it's too depressing. People may read this and say, I really want to go into this knowing what's happening and knowing that that it's not like Law and Order. So this is I think a lot of material in law schools, unfortunately, is very abstract, and that people need to get something that's more concrete. And so this is about how a courtroom works. In terms of disillusionment with the legal system, was I disillusioned? I found people working hard. I tended, you know, it's not true for everyone in the system, of course, but I think for the most part, people are smart. They work hard, they mean to do well, and they feel badly that they can't do better because of how the system is designed. Ultimately, we can improve how people are processed through the system a little bit, but the solutions to our problems are going to have to come from outside the courthouse. The courthouse is the end of the line, really. That's where people are processed when they've already gotten into trouble. So we have to go back to what we knew and talked about more in the 1970s, the connection between poverty and crime, because it's so striking in a courthouse.
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Urbana, line two. Hi.
Good afternoon. I'm wondering, when you are interviewing your defendants, do you often find that there's a family history of incarceration with other family members? Is that more common than not, or is that something you even approached?
Yeah, I did look at that, and it was very common. There were family histories of not only incarceration, but there were often family histories of abuse and neglect. And this was not just on the defendant's word. I think people think that defendants are always making excuses, you know, saying, well, mom beat me, that's why I'm doing this. Defendants actually are reluctant to talk about abuse in their family in most cases. But sometimes I have other sources, some records I can look at, or when I get to talk to a defendant enough, things will come out. They'll tell me about how they got punched in the stomach when they were a kid for discipline, and they'll say it as if, well, you know, as one defendant said, when you bad kids, that's what you get. They don't look on this as abuse, but I think a lot of violent criminals or people who are violent criminals came from homes when they were treated where they were treated violently, and we just don't want to connect the dots here because it's easier to say, well, they're just evil. That's the reason they're committing these crimes. But abuse and neglect in the backgrounds of defendants really is rampant.
Well, not only abuse and neglect, but I mean the fact that maybe they had other family members that had been incarcerated. I just wonder if you know, what kind of a pattern you see there.
It's very frequent that if I, you know, I have a guy in the book named Kevin Betts who was on trial for murder, and he's wearing the suit at the defense table of his brother who is incarcerated. I say he can't use the suit because he's locked up for, I believe it was aggravated kidnapping. It is really striking how many times siblings are locked up in various institutions and sometimes also their parents.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. We're going to have to wrap up here. Before we go, we haven't really talked too much about the so-called heater cases. These are the cases that get a lot of attention. How do high-profile cases affect a courtroom and the quality of justice that's meted out in a courtroom?
It's a double-edged sword, Celeste, because they do get more time and more consideration, but the parties, you know, everybody's on their best behavior. In this courtroom, when there was a heater case up, the judge got a haircut, the clerk got a haircut, the deputy got a haircut. Everybody wants to look their best and do their best, but sometimes what is decided is affected by the judge and the lawyers knowing that people are watching, and it's having that effect isn't always a good thing because sometimes it's better for people just to decide based on the facts of the case and the situation of the defendant.
Mm. What was it like getting those guys in who were taking in the prisoners to talk with you, you know?
The deputies?
Yeah, and the watch commander and those folks. Not only did you talk to defendants and attorneys and the judge, but you talked to these guys as well.
Yeah, and I thought that was really important. These people are never talked to, and no one observes how inmates are treated in the lockups behind the courtroom and in the basement of the courthouse. and you know why they allowed, why they ended up doing the kinds of things they did when I was there, I'm not sure, but they were pretty open. If you talk to people long enough, or if you're around long enough, they forget you're there, and you get to see more about how they normally act. There was a watch commander in the basement who said that he was technically in charge of security in the courthouse, and he was talking about the defendants being processed in the basement and saying that he allows his sergeant to run the show. He really didn't want to know what went on down there. He said, an occupational hazard of my job is the stiff neck that you can get from looking the other way. And I think that's true of not just the deputies, but all of us. We've gotten a stiff neck from looking the other way about these kinds of problems. And this book is an attempt to get us to look at the situation.
Very good. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon, Steve.
Great to talk with you, Celeste.
Steve Bogira, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of Courtroom 302, A Year Behind the Scenes in an American Criminal Courthouse. That American Criminal Courthouse, the Cook County Courthouse. The book published by Knopf. You've been listening to an interview from the AM 580 archives. You'll find interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and Focus 580 on our website. Visit will.uiuc.edu.
I'm Todd Gleason. You are listening to the Afternoon Magazine. Time now for a look at what happened to the Chicago Board of Trade and how the settlements came across on this Wednesday afternoon. July futures in the wheat pit were down a penny and three quarters this afternoon, a high of 339 and three quarters for the day, the low at 325 and a half, and a settlement price at 330 and a quarter. Once again, the July soft red winter wheat futures were down one and three quarters in Chicago. September futures down 2 cents today, 348 and a half, the high, the low there at 330. Settled at 340 and a quarter. December contract in the wheat pit, 359 and a half on the high side, the low at 345 and a half. Settled 349 and three quarters. They were down a penny and three quarters in the March contract in the wheat pit, 367 and a half the high, the low at 355 and a half, and a settlement at 360 even. They were down one and one half for the day. From the corn pit, a penny and a half higher in the nearby July futures, 227 and a half the high, the low at 218 and a half, settled at 222 and three quarters. Once again, that July contract, your lead option, up one and one half. September, 235 and a quarter high, low at 226 and three quarters, and a settlement price at 230 and three quarters. They were up a penny and three quarters in the December futures. This is your harvest month. New crop, 244 the high, low at 235 and three quarters. Settlement there at $2.39 and three quarters cents a bushel. They were up one and one half. March corn now, 252 the high, low at 244, settled at 247 and a half, up one and a half in the May contract. A 256 high, low at 249, settled at 252. They were up one and one quarter. And July for next year, looking out, 260 and a half the high, the low at 52 and a half, settlement price at 56 and a half, and they were up a penny and a half for the day. July oats, 140 the high, the low at 136 and a quarter. July oats at the Board of Trade, 137 and a half, the settlement price a penny higher. And the September futures, 143 and a quarter the high, the low at 140 and three quarters, a settlement price at 140 and a quarter, up three quarters. From the soy complex, another big day in the bean pit, and we'll talk to Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois, about the move here. Up 21 cents in the July. November futures are up 19 and a half. The settlements came across like this at the end of the day, 115 when they closed at 668 for the July beans on the high, the low at $6.51, settled 666 and one half. They were up 21 cents. August futures in the bean pit, 667 and a half, or rather 667 even the high. The low at 651 and one half, and a settlement price at $6.66. They were up 20 and a half. September contract now, 666 the high, low at 653, settled 664 and a half. They were up 19 and three quarters in the Novembers. A 666 high today there as well. The low at 651, settlement price just a half below that high at $6.65 and a half cents. They were up 19 and a half. January futures, 668 the high, the low at 54 and a half, settled $6.66 and one quarter cents, up 21. and the March futures, 666.5, the high, the low at 654, and a settlement price at 666.25, up 20.75. Boy, I hope tomorrow they trade past that 666. It's just too hard to say as a tongue twister. Bean meal futures, a meal July contract, 208, the high, the low at 201, settled at $207.70. They were up $9 even. August meal up $8.30, 208, the high, the low at 201.70. Settlement price, they're at 207 even. They were up $8.30. July bean oil, $23.39, the high, the low at 23, settled at $23.25, up 38. And the August contract now at $23.33 settlement, and they were up 39 for the day with a high of $23.45 and a low at $23.08. From the Mercantile Exchange, numbers like this in the Peter Cattle Pit, the nearby May contract, 111.20 the high, the low at 110.90, settled 111.02.5. They were off 30 cents the August, down 25 cents, 110.80 the settlement price with a high of 111 even, and the low at 110.10. Feeder cattle for the September contract, 110.10 the high, the low at 109.25. Settlement price there at 110.05, and they were a nickel lower for the day. Live cattle, June contract, 15 cents higher, 84.65 the high, the low at 84.20. Settlement price, once again, up 15 cents at $84.60 a hundredweight for the June live cattle. August live cattle, 84.10 the high, the low at 83.55, settled at 84.07.5. And they were 15 cents higher. June live hogs for the day, 71.87.5 the high. The low at 70.85, settled 71.65, down 30 cents. July futures were up 42.5 cents, $71 a hundredweight, the final price for the day, with a high of 71.42.5 and a low at 69.85. And the August contract, 70.37.5, the high, the low at 68.35, a settlement at 70.07.5. They were up 80. We'll close out with the October lean hogs, $60.60, the high, the low at 59.50, and a settlement at $60.15 even. They were unchanged for the day.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM, working with the American farmer, creating products from his crops, creating markets for his crops. ADM, resourceful by nature.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Ronnie McDaniel from Albany, Georgia writes, "Dear Dr. Science, why do certain plants produce caffeine? Is it a natural pesticide? What is the adaptive advantage for the plant when it produces a stimulant?"
Plants want to get high too. Even bugs want to get off. But they're so sensitive to certain chemicals, they OD on their way to a perfect buzz. Yes, this war on drugs is nothing new. It's been going on in the natural world since the dawn of creation. Ever wonder what it's like to be a plant? I mean, what do plants think about? Come to think of it, what do cows think about? Are they naturally high all the time, or are they just so spaced out they're not really thinking about anything? I had a graduate student like that once. He gave the impression of being lost in thought, but in the final analysis, he was just lost.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Dex Breath and distributed by PRI. For information online about the